tried the new idea this week of having review questions at the end of the source sheet. Of course, they're all the way at the end of the source sheet, suggesting we're going to get there, which, you know, we all know what that means. But I like Louise's idea. I only had a question about it. Louise had suggested to me maybe also in the beginning of the source sheet, since I send it out in advance, maybe some note about what to look at as you're preparing the chapter, in that you'll know like where we're headed. I think it's a fine idea. My only question is, will people actually use that in advance to prepare the chapter? Because I only send it out on, you know, a day before sometimes, you know, max 2 days before. So if that would be useful, it's not really hard for me to add that. Yeah. Right, that's true. Right. So maybe I'll... No, it's not a lot of work to add that. That's not... Yeah. The review questions at the end are harder to come up with. The in advance of look at this, this, and this is actually... You know, since I've prepared the class already, it's not, you know, it's not hard to do that. I think it's a good idea. Thank you. Whether I'll actually remember when I'm doing it and all that is another story. Okay, so we are in chapter 23, page 991 in the Stone Tanakh. Chapter 23. This is the last of the messages regarding various enemies. It is about Sore, it is about Tyre, and last time we began by asking what our relationship is with these people of Sore, of Tyre. Why are we against them? Barbanel noted the claim that it was Venice, and he discarded that idea. But our history with Sor is mixed. One of the questions involved was the question of whether we're meant to read Sor and Sidon as working together, like Barbanel said, or as two nations with independent faiths, which was the way Malvim read it. But Sor and Sidon are north of Israel along the Mediterranean coast. They are seafaring nations. We noted last time, it will come back again this time, that Sidon is the firstborn of Canaan. Canaan, son of Ham. So Canaan's firstborn son is Sidon. We don't have a genealogy for Tzor. Sidon, I noted also last time, has their land actually taken at one point by the tribe of Dan. Unclear whether it was considered part of Israel originally or not. But we have a very mixed relationship with them. On the one hand, there's a great height for Tzor in that Hiram, King Hiram, has a covenant with David. He builds a palace for David. He has a covenant with Shlomo. He builds the Beis HaMikdash. Like, you know, what else could you want? On the other hand, Sidon has, the king of Sidon's daughter is Izebel, who, of course, we do not really approve of. Murdering people and idolatry and that kind of thing. And then her daughter Atalia, who murders the royal family and is herself eventually killed. These are a problem. So the relationship with them can be characterized as up and down, with some pretty severe ups and some pretty severe downs. We noted as well three biblical prophecies against Tzor, which includes some identification of Tzor's wrongdoings. So Amos spoke about them harming us by selling us to Edom and not honoring the covenant of brothers, which we took possibly to be the covenant of Hiram with Shlomo, which is found in Malachim and Kings. So they betrayed us. Yoel also speaks about them betraying us, taking our money and selling us to the Greeks or the Romans. And then we had Yechezkel, who spends three chapters on Tzor, chapters 26, 27, and 28, in which he describes their fall to Babylon and or to flooding. And he identifies their sins as egging on the destruction of the temple, as well as their general arrogance. He also describes a lot of commercial success for them. So the commentators borrow from those prophecies in order to fill in here and explain what it is that Tzor has done to earn its downfall, because Yeshaya doesn't actually say. So there is an indication that they're involved with the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, but that's hard to read here, because here most commentators assume that we're talking about their downfall at the hands of the Assyrians or the Babylonians, which is long before the second temple destruction. So I'm not saying they couldn't have had both, meaning nations in this region rise and fall and rise. So it could very well be. They get leveled by the Assyrians. They could come back, get leveled again by the Babylonians, come back again, and then be involved in the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, the second temple as well. But my point is that this prophecy seems to be predicting a destruction which is earlier than the fall of the second temple, and therefore whatever they did to earn this demise must have been something earlier. We noted that Abarbanel, based on Yoel, says they kidnapped Jewish youths and sold them. And then we have the view that seems to be supported in Yoel and Yechezkel that their sin is somehow related to commerce. They cheat people, they're dishonest in business, they damaged us commercially. But what I suggested at the end last time is that there doesn't have to be a transgression here. It's entirely possible that they haven't done anything wrong. This section in Yeshaya is fundamentally a message of don't rely on alliances, because all of those nations are going to fall. They can't be your supports. So maybe Tzor hasn't done anything wrong, or has done anything wrong yet. But we have seen them as our allies, going back to the time of David, going back to the time of Shlomo, and we're being warned, you can't rely on them.
Didn't Shlomo form an alliance because he wanted to get the wood from Tzor?
Yeah, the wood and the craftsmen. The materials without the craftsmen, you know, you can order all the stuff you want from IKEA, but if you're no good with a wrench, you know, you're out of luck.
Now you know.
Yes, Susan.
You keep talking about Tzor. How is Tarshish considered like the partner? So when you said Tzor, you mean both?
So I'm going to come back to Tarshish when we actually see the chapter. So hold the question. But Tzor is neither Tarshish is neither Tzor nor Tzidon. It's a completely different party that's involved in trade with them. But I'm going to talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
So that brings us to two opening questions, which are, first of all, so when is it that Tzor is going to fall? When will it be demolished? And the big question in my mind is, why are they here on this list that that Yeshaya presents, the list of the nations in the region who fall? I would have expected the list would have ended with Yerushalayim. Right? You talk about the fall of Yehuda, right? That's the last word. Why is it that you have an epilogue almost here? Oh, and by the way, Tzor is going to fall. What is it about Tzor that they should be so special? They get that last spot on the list after us. Once we've seen that and we've addressed that, I'm going to move on to some highlights within the prophecy itself to help us understand the chapter. But as I said in my email, I'm doing this as an experiment. I want to ditch the line by line by line, word by word by word, because I really think that it's not a good learning experience. The more I do it, the more I see it, the more I think that it's just it's not as effective in terms of us actually learning what we're trying to learn and remembering what we're trying to remember. So we'll see. But in terms of the question of when Tzor is demolished, so you have a range of views. There's a Rashi, which I brought you in source number one. The vision to Tzor begins by saying that the boats of Tarshish should wail. And then it says, Kishudad mibayit mibo, which the take in Rashi is, they have been destroyed. Tzor is destroyed, mibayit, meaning from within. May Eretz Kitim nigla lama. The way Rashi reads it is that from the land of Kitim, the invader was revealed. Meaning, our enemy comes from Kitim. What in the world is Kitim? So Rashi says to you in number one, Haim haromiyim. It refers to the Romans. In other words, as far as Rashi in the beginning of the chapter is concerned, this is foretelling something way in the future. The Romans are going to destroy Tyre. Later in the chapter, towards the end, Rashi actually has the Babylonians do it, so I'm a little confused by that. But that's what this Rashi indisputably says. The mainstream view, Ibn Ezra, Radak, Malbim, is that it's about the Babylonians. The Babylonians are going to do this destruction. So I brought you Radak in source number two, and I'm going to stick with my English in the interest of time. We see that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed her, as is explained in Yechezkel, Yechezkel's vision of the downfall of Tyre. The Kittim are Greek. That's what he says. It says Kittim are Greek. So what does it mean when the text seems to say she is exiled from the land of the Kittim? That's how he reads the opening verse in the chapter. He says if it's the Babylonians, it's not the Greeks.
He says it's the Romans.
Right, well, he's not bothered by that. I mean, Rashi's saying that they're Romans, really. You have to remember the way that the sages classically view the Romans, which is the way the historians, frankly, have viewed the Romans, as blending with the Greeks. So that's the way that he'll account for Rashi. But he says neither Greeks nor Romans are the ones we're talking about in destroying them. So he says, my father, the Radak says, my father explained that Kittim were merchants who traveled to Babylon and told them to come to Tyre that they could conquer it, and they would help them and come to them via the sea. They allied them. Kittim were merchants who allied themselves with the Babylonians. By the way, parenthetical but worth knowing, you ever see as you're driving along the highway a truck with a container, with a shipping container on it, and a star and writing in Hebrew? Zim, yeah. Correct. Zim, or Z-I-M. Zim. You know where that name comes from.
Here.
Balak. Bilam, in his prediction of what's going to happen in the future, says, Vitzim miyad kitim. Zim, coming from kitim. Kitim are merchants. The term tzi is a term you're going to see here in this chapter. It's a reference to ships. These were merchant ships. So that's where they got it from. Okay, not Zimmerman. Nope.
No, I just Zimmerman.
Okay, so your second take is that it is Nebuchadnezzar coming in to destroy them. The third approach is Abarbanel, in his introduction to the chapter, says that it's actually about the Assyrians. He says, commentators to this chapter have made a mistake. They assume that Yeshaya and Yechezkel are talking about the same thing. Yechezkel for sure says the Babylonians are going to destroy Tyre. But Abarbanel says, that's not what Yeshaya is talking about. Of course Yechezkel says that. Yechezkel is at the time of the destruction of the first temple. The Babylonians are sweeping through. But Yeshaya is way earlier. The Assyrians haven't come through yet, he says. So take a look at source number 3. He says, that which the commentators wrote, that the destruction mentioned by Yeshaya in this prophecy is the same as that mentioned by Yechezkel, is a clear error in my eyes. You know, he's very unsure of himself. Yeshaya did not mention that Nebuchadnezzar would come upon Tyre as Yechezkel did. And he goes on with other reasons for saying what he says, and he says, because of all these reasons, I have said that the two prophets did not have the same signum in this matter. Their prophecies were different, even though both of them prophesied regarding Tyre. But Yeshayahu mentioned that Tyre would be brought low, for raiders would attack her via Sancheirib. And I have no doubt this was in the time of Chizkiyahu. And because when Jerusalem was first destroyed, Tyre rejoiced at the destruction of Judea and did not remember the covenant of brothers or the love of neighbors, therefore destruction and complete collapse were decreed for Tyre and Sidon for that sin. And regarding that second great complete downfall which came to them via Nebuchadnezzar, Yechezkel prophesied. So, three different views about when this downfall is supposed to take place. Is it way in the future, Romans? Is it Nebuchadnezzar? Or is it near term, the Assyrians? Clear? Hello? If it's not, you got to say so. You have three different visions. The bottom line is, you have Rashi telling you it's the Romans. Rashi is building off the word Kittim, which we associate as some kind of Greek island. And so he says that it's actually the Romans doing this far in the future. You have Radak, who says that it's actually Nebuchadnezzar who's going to come to despoil them. Nebuchadnezzar doing it, like the vision that Yechezkel has, that Nebuchadnezzar is going to destroy Tyre. And then you have Abarbanel, who says Yechezkel's talking about some different event. Yeshaya is talking about the Assyrians doing it. Then they will rise up again, and then the Babylonians will come and knock them down again. That's your sort of in a nutshell summary.
So this is all Yeshaya saying this, and everyone is interpreting her name.
Correct, because Yeshayahu doesn't name the enemy. Well, that depends on who you believe.
So he's saying not only is it it's going to happen. Different things are going to happen. He's saying it to different people.
Remember that this section in Yeshayahu 13-23 jumps around in time.
Right.
So this could be a prophecy that's after the fall to the of Yisrael to the Assyrians. It's entirely possible. Yeshayahu certainly survives that. For he lives a long period after. Not a long period. He lives after that. Yeah. Or we've seen with some of his prophecies, they're sealed away by his students and meant for a later generation. So the big question here is, why is Tyre at this place on the list? Why are they the last one to be targeted? So part of it, perhaps it could be, because they represent commercial success, right? As I noted regarding what their sin was, bless you, it may not have been a sin. It's just that we have come to rely on them as allies. And so the statement here is, don't rely on those you think are your supporters. And in fact, Yeshayahu is going to focus on their commercial success. And he's going to degrade their commercial success. We're going to see him compare commercial success to zinut, to immorality, to promiscuity. That's one possible approach, is that they are here on the list because they represent the successful nation who we have come to rely on. Maybe it's a thought. Abarbanel says it's on the list here because it is immediate, because he believes that it's going to be when the Assyrians invade, which is the next part of the book, is the Assyrian invasion, the next narrative section. So Abarbanel takes the view that that's why this is here. Take a look at number 6. Bless you. Number 6. Abarbanel from his introduction to chapter 23. Because this prophecy related to the times of Chizkiyahu, therefore it came in this place, after the story of Shaphna and Eliakim, and then came the prophecy of chapter 24 and the rest of the ensuing prophecies. It's here because it belongs here. First we talked about Shaphna, and he ties into the Assyrian invasion. Now we talk about Tsor, because they're going to fall on the Assyrian invasion. And that's the theme for this section. Abarbanel says it fits the context. Clear? Do we grasp that? The third approach, I kind of scratched my head over this one, literally, actually. Rabbi Yoel ben Nun has an essay called Tsor v'Tzidon b'Nachalat Asher. Tsor and Sidon in the portion of Asher, in which he claims that Tsor and Sidon intermarried with Jews. So there are Jews living among them. So since, and by the way, you find that idea also that Tsor had married among Jews in Abarbanel in Malachim. When he talks about Chirom and Chiram, it's a longer story. But
didn't Shlomo give cities to Chiram or something?
Yes, he did.
And they lived there.
Correct. So they lived clearly among us and with us. And so the suggestion that Rabbi Yoel ben Nun makes is that since they had intermarried with the Jews, therefore, when it talks about the fall of Judea, then it also talks about the fall of Tsor, among whom Jews had married. The problem that I have with that idea is, then why not mention that intermarriage in all your prophecies about Tsor? Like, there's nothing there to make that association. So I have difficulty with that. And then one more idea, which I found intriguing enough that I translated it in source number 7. This is Rabbi Mati Goldreich in Israel. I don't know which yeshiva he's affiliated with, but I found his essay called Nagid al Ami Yisrael. He focuses on the word Nagid, which is used in different contexts. Sometimes it's used for Shaul, sometimes it's used for David. Nagid, of course, is a leader of some kind, someone who draws the nation along. We think of Shmuel HaNagid always, that's very popular. And he notes that the word Nagid is used for Tsor, including in this prophecy. Where is the word Nagid in this chapter? I remember it was here, but now I'm trying to find it. Sorry?
It's
God is the form of fulfillment. Oh, it's prophecy.
No. Okay. No, that's different. The anyone see the word nagid in the Hebrew? Yeah, in the Hebrew. It was here. He didn't make it up. But now, of course, I'm not finding it. Or maybe he was just talking about Nagid being used elsewhere for Chiram. That could be. That could be that it's not actually in this chapter. Because I'm not seeing it right now. Okay. Either way, the word Nagid is indeed used for them. It's only whether it's here or whether it's in another chapter regarding Chiram. But take a look at what he has to say in number 7. He argues that Sor represents the best of the nations of the world. That's the way he views it. My translation is on the top of the next slide. He says, we'll use the title Nagid and say that Tyre is not a rejected part of the Israelite nation, Rabbi Yoel ben Nun's point, but a portion of the nations drawn close. They are part of the nations who have been drawn close to us. It is a form of fulfillment of Yeshaya's prophecy where we said many nations will go and say, let us ascend to the mountain of God. These are the nations who build the Beit HaMikdash, he argues. That's not necessarily the way everyone takes that. We learned different views when we learned that chapter in Yeshaya. But his point is, these are the nations who build the Beit HaMikdash, who value Solomon not for his wealth or strength, but for his great wisdom, and they rejoice greatly for this. And he refers you to Malachim Aleph, to Kings 1, where we're told that Hiram, king of Tzor, rejoices over the wisdom of Shlomo. They recognize that, quote, this great nation is only a wise and understanding nation. This holds a greatly elevated potential, not only to unify the powers of Yisrael and Yehuda as one in building the Beit HaMikdash, but even to bring in the nations as partners. This is the height of all humanity. This was the expectation for Tyre and for their king, Hiram. They were supposed to be wonderful, and they let God down. And because they let God down when they became arrogant, therefore, they're last on this list. They are the one who could have been the best, and instead they plummeted. Support for this idea is found in our chapter. Take a look at chapter 23, sentence 12. The phrase that's used to refer to Sidon, who we're lumping in with Tyre.
But you're
not that serious. Bitulat bat Sidon. It's Yeshaya having fun. Bitulat bat Sidon. The Bitulat, daughter of Sidon, and of course we are familiar with the phrase Bitulat bat Sion. Normally, that's in Eicha. It's also in Yeshaya in chapter 37. It's also in Malachim Beth, the joys of having a CD-ROM. But the Bitulat bat Sion is a familiar term for us, and it's Bitulat bat Sidon because they could have been like us. So I thought that was a very interesting read. So they are here at the last on the list, either because it fits the context, okay, I'm doing my summary now of this section, either just because it fits the context, right, the fall to the Assyrians is when this is happening, according to Abarbanel, maybe because they intermarry with the Jews, there are Jews among them, and they are this rejected portion of the Jewish people, or alternatively, is that they are the best of the nations. They could have been everything, and now they let God down. And therefore, they're there at the end. Clear? Okay. So, this chapter actually has a very easy cheat to it. It's something which we've talked about on occasion before, as a structure that you will find in places in Tanakh that can really help you grasp the core of a message. And I realized this was here, and then saw that Abarbanel actually referred to it. But I saw it first. I saw it first, just, 600 years later. 500 years later. Take a look at Pasuk Aleph, sentence 1, and compare it with sentence 14.
In the same chapter.
Same chapter. 23. Chapter 23. You got it. What do you see?
Same words.
Same words. Right. in Pasuk Aleph, Heilili Oniyot Tarshish, whale boats of Tarshish, and then again in Pasuk Yudalid, Heilili Oniyot Tarshish. And again, there it's Kishudad Mibayt Mibo, Kishudad Ma'uzchem. It's the same turn of phrase. When you see that, perk up your ears. That means that there is an envelope going on here very often. An envelope meaning you have a wrapper for what's going on in between. And what you can often find when you have a wrapper like that, there's something like that also in Shmuel regarding, I think it's Shmuel Perek Bet? No, Shmuel Perek Gimel. When it talks about the rise of Shmuel and the fall of the house of Eli, what you can find inside of that is a kind of symmetrical construction leading to the middle of the envelope where your core message is found. Nachama Leibowitz, I'm told, does this a lot. I haven't really read enough of her to say that I know that, but I'm told that she makes use of this. Take a look at source number 8 where I gave you a representation of this. In sentence 1, cry Tarshish, wail boats of Tarshish. Tarshish, in terms of the question now that Susan asked before, is the mighty seafaring nation. It's a great port on the Mediterranean. There's a lot of debate as to where it is. The consensus that I've seen is that it's somewhere in Turkey, but it's a port city on the Mediterranean, which is important enough that when Yonah goes down to the sea, what does he find? A boat headed for Tarshish.
Well, it's only a city as opposed to Tsur.
Correct. Tsur is a nation. Tarshish is a port. Correct. I mean, for all I know, it was autonomous back in their day. I don't know. But they are going to suffer, as we're going to discuss, because of the fall of their trading partner, Tsur. That's what happens. So cry Tarshish because Tsur is going to fall. And then the next 5 psukim, sentences 2-6, talk about the fall of the seafaring economy. The ones who had traded with Tsur, now they are devastated as though they had never produced anything. Malbim has a slightly different read, but I'm okay with that. I'm following the main approach here, which I think fits the words very nicely, so that if you look at Pasuk Dalet at sentence 4, right, the statement of Lo chalti v'lo yaladati v'lo gidalti bachurim romamti betulot, I never produced anything, I never produced any descendants. They're going to say we are completely devastated as though we had produced nothing. That's the second stage of it. Parallel to that, at the end of the chapter, sentences 10-13 describe the extent of the devastation, the fall of the Aliza, this population that had been so powerful and so beautiful and so beloved, and the middle of the envelope, bracketed by the fall of the seafaring economy, is sentences 7-9. That's the middle of the envelope. Let's take a look at sentences 7-9, and you'll see why. It is page 991. Hazos lachem aliza. Is it this that has come to you? Mimei kedem kadmasa yovilua raglea merachok lagur. He says, the one who, they put it here, dwellers, what was it? No, not that. Whose origins were in ancient days. Yeah, that's Rashi. They mimei kedem kadmasa. Her beginning was back in the early days. Yoviluha raglea merachok lagur. Her legs bring her from afar. To dwell, meaning they're going to be taking her to exile far away. Miya az zos al sor hama tira. Who was it who came up with this against Sor, who wore the crown? Asher sochara sarim, whose merchants are officers. Kin aneha, I'm going to come back to later, but it means her merchants. Are nichvadei aretz, were honored people in the land. Who could have done this to Tsur? And the answer, as always in Yeshaya, Hashem tzvakos yatza. God was the one who plotted this, to destroy them, to bring them to shame and so forth. So in other words, what Yeshaya is doing here with this envelope is, cry Tarshish, the seafaring economy is collapsing and is destroyed, because Hashem has planned this. That's the message that he's bringing with this envelope. I did note one thing for you. No, I didn't actually. Good. It would have been a distraction. I thought I brought on the sheet, but I didn't. But as mentioned, there's a medrash in Shmos Rabbah which picks up on a verse which says, Kasher Shema LeMitzrayim, which is usually read when Egypt hears of the fall of Tyre, because again, they're also trading partners. But Kasher Shema LeMitzrayim is taken in the medrash as happened to Egypt. Tyre is going to experience what Egypt experienced at the sea. It's a clever read. The one thing that's particularly interesting here is in sentence 13. There's an odd phrase. Hein eretz kasdim, ze ha'am lo haya. What in the world does that mean? The land of the Chaldeans, this nation wasn't. And then, Ashur yisada litziyim, there's the word si. Ashur was founded, or founded her, for tziyim. How do they translate tziyim here? Fleets. Boats. There's your reference to the tzi. But what is it, what are you talking about? This nation that wasn't? Was established by the Assyrians? Is that what you're trying to say? It's a hard verse, no? Sorry? It makes sense, but I don't get it. So, two different approaches. Rashi's approach is that this is a message still about the fall of Tzor. And what he says is that Babylon is going to destroy Tzor. They are not Rome. This is where Rashi, again, says not Rome, but Babylon instead. And what Rashi says is, Ze ha'am lo haya, means this is a nation that God wishes had never existed. Where does Rashi get that from? Where Rashi gets a lot of great ideas. The Gemara, source number 9. I didn't translate the whole thing for you because it's a quote of 4 different verses. But the Gemara there says that there are 4 entities God regrets creating. Exile, the phenomenon of Galut, the Chaldeans, the Kasdim, Yishmaelim, and the Yetzer Hara. In context, this Gemara is talking about the Yetzer Hara. That's really the focus of that Gemara. If you ever want to learn the Gemara about the Yetzer Hara, you definitely want to see the end of Sukkah, because that has quite a bit about it. But he builds on our verse here about the Chaldeans, about the Kasdim, to say God wishes they had never existed. Assyria founded them. That's a straight pasuk. The Torah says in Parshas. Noach, min ha'aretz ha'hi atzah, Ashur va'iven is Nineveh, ves mechavos ir, ves kalach, ves resen, and so on. The Assyrians, original Ashur, built Babel, and they built it in order to have it for their ships. I mean, technically, Kasdim and Babel are not the same, but they're close enough for our purposes. And they are going to be the ones to destroy Tzor. That's Rashi's read. Radak, though, gives you something that I think adds a dimension to it. He says, that's not the idea of Ha'am Lo Haya. Ha'am Lo Haya means, this nation did not exist. And then they came to exist. Meaning, there's a rise and fall of nations. Nations don't exist, they come into existence, and then they're destroyed by somebody else. Actually, no. Along the way, they usually destroy somebody, and then they themselves get destroyed. That's the way it works. And so what he's saying of Tzor is, don't be shocked when this happens to you. The Chaldeans didn't exist. They rose. And there was a cycle of rising and falling. And the same thing will be true for you. Take a look at source number 10. Babylon, Nineveh, the rest of the land, which is the land of the Chaldeans today, this nation was not there originally. Assyria established it for the Tziyim. Now, he takes Tziyim differently. The word Tziyim can refer to Tziyah, which is a ruin. Midbar, Bidiuk, Nachon. A ruin. Chaldeans were descendants of Kesed, son of Nahor, right? The end of Vayera, you get that lineage. Kasdim, Kesed. They conquered that land, and today it is called Land of the Chaldeans. Assyria originally established it, which is why it is included in Assyria. But today it belongs to Babylon and the Chaldeans. They conquered it. They established the towers it has today. They destroyed the palaces she had originally and made her a ruin. And he said that Assyria established this land in which the dwellers of tents in the ruined land had lived beforehand. And he recited this verse regarding Tyre as if to say, don't be shocked if Tyre is ruined. For the Chaldean forces, which have come to destroy their land, also formerly belonged to another. And then they took it from its first residence, and yet others will take it from them. That's the way of the world. This one ascends, this one descends, showing that God is master of the world. Susan.
It says, I know you don't like it. It says, anyways, okay. RV here, renders it more in the usual sense. Assyria hath appointed it for the beasts of the wilderness. Has that ever been used?
Yeah, that was when I said that Sia is a ruin.
Yeah,
Siyim will be inhabitants of Tzia.
So where are the beasts from?
Because who else lives in Tzia? Who else lives in a ruin?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's how they're... Yeah.
I couldn't figure out where the beasts
Yeah, are. No, they should have shown all work. But yes, that's the idea. So this piece of Zeha Amloaya, the Chaldeans weren't, either means that God hates the Chaldeans, who were the ones who were founded by the Assyrians, and they're going to destroy Tyre, or the Chaldeans weren't, and then they came to be, and they were powerful, and then they fall, and that's the way it works. That's what happens to nations. And Tyre, you should stop crying about it. That's basically the idea. Barbanel thinks that this is actually offering consolation to Tsor, but that's another read I'm not going to go into. The bottom line, again, just to recap and make sure that we have some semblance of understanding what we're talking about. Again, this is still downfall of Tyre, downfall of Tsor. We've seen how most of the chapter is an envelope that's meant to highlight in the middle of it that this is from God, that this is coming to Tsor, but it's going to have repercussions for the entire seafaring economy. And you have this line about the Kazdim, the Chaldeans, who may be the ones who are going to destroy Tsor, or maybe not, depending on how you read it. And either God is expressing animosity towards them, or God is saying to the people of Tsor, this happens, it's the way it goes. But now we get to the fun part of the chapter. Rhea, look, you're looking up like you wanted to ask something, or?
No, I don't know what this has to do with us.
Right,
With Israel.
Correct. And the answer goes back to what we had said before, right? Which was either that it's they did something to us, and then we have to figure out what it is, and we have these different views. Did they kidnap our children? Did they intermarry among them? What was it that they did to cause them to be brought down? That was one explanation. Second explanation was just that it's speaking about events that are going to take place during the invasion of the Assyrians, and so it just fits into there, into that that slot, so to speak. Or alternatively, it is just warning us to don't rely on them. In the same way that we're warned, don't rely on all these nations. Yeah, correct.
But it goes in great detail to tell us what's
yes.
Like, you can just say don't rely on them, and then
yeah.
Rather than go through the whole thing.
Right, and
the
when
whole paragraph, right.
Right. Well, what I want to do is, after we see the end of the chapter and a little bit of language, I want to talk about this whole theme of the downfall of the seafaring economy, because I think that there's another piece to all of this underlying it, which is important to recognize. Susan.
This is more a general question. When you have so many commentaries with different answers, how do you come to a sort of solution, semblance of idea of what you want, where to go, because they're quite different.
Yeah, and the answer is it depends on how masochistic you are.
Oh.
No, in all seriousness. Moshe's shaking his head, yes. In all seriousness, each one of them has a track through the book and certainly the chapter that is intended to be consistent. They're picking up on certain cues that will help explain what's going on. Often it relates to how they explain other chapters and other sections in Tanakh, and they'll see something there that they believe is parallel here. And so you may need a greater perception in order to really grasp why they're doing what they're doing. But you can just say what Art Scroll says, which is, we're going to do this with one commentator and just follow him no matter what. So they're going to follow Rashi. and Rashi is what's going to inform their translation. And maybe on the bottom they'll give you a note or two that come from somebody else, but they're sticking to Rashi. What I'm trying to do, hopefully without causing more confusion, is to show sometimes the different views, like on Zeha'am Lo Haya, in an attempt to show that you really can read this in different ways and provide greater scope.
And then we're supposed to sort of come to a conclusion who we want to follow, or
no?
Okay, I know more.
Why do you need to paskin?
No, I don't mean paskin.
No, but what I'm saying is like
our scroll decided. Yeah. And I'm saying so, like, because I've got all these ideas, so the next step may not agree with the previous idea because I thought of Barbanella, say, instead of. So you sort of have to have this idea in your head that there are so many. And
right. Usually what I find happens is that when you're dealing with a theme or section that runs for a long time, eventually you find yourself narrowing it down to one, maybe two approaches and saying, okay, this is what I have and I'm just going to follow along those lines. So an example of that, we have the Shmuel Shir on Thursdays and you're there by FaceTime. So when we started the section there about the selection of Shaul as a king, or really even before that, the nation choosing Shaul as a king, we saw that God wasn't happy about it, but was going along with it, and we gave four different views, I think, for what it was that was wrong with their request for a king. But at the end, we more or less settled on the Ran's approach, which is, what's wrong is they want to replace rulership by God with rulership by a human being who will not turn to God, and therefore we understand all the ups and downs of Shaul's life in that light. We had other views, but we sort of dropped them because they didn't fit as well. Yeah. And the same thing in this section of 13 to 23. Originally, when we started this section, we gave different explanations for why Yeshaya is talking about what's going to happen to the nations of the region, but we've basically settled on one explanation, which is, it's warning us against alliances with them. You know? So I think that's what happens. You sort of flatten out over time. Yeah. So, the end of this chapter is a lot of fun. Jump to sentence 15, please. This we're going to read. You know what's going to happen on that day? Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. If you understood that phrase, you're way ahead of me. At the end of 70 years, will be for Tyre like the song of the Zona. I don't know what that means yet.
Oh my God.
Take a kinor. Use your favorite stringed instrument there. Sobi ear. Surround the city. Zona nishkacha. Forgotten zona. Hey TV nagain harbi shir. Play good music. Play a lot of songs. Leman tizacheri. So that you will be remembered. In other words, what he's saying here is, Tyre is going to suffer this calamity. 70 years, Tyre is going to be forgotten. Whatever this one king is. At the end of 70 years, though, Tyre will be restored, like with the song of the Zona. What that means is, as classically explained by the commentators, is that the Zona, who people don't are not interested anymore, tries to sing in order to get them to pay attention to her. And that's what he's saying here, that Tyre is going to try to attract people's attention. And after 70 years, Yifkod Hashem et Tzor v'shava le'esnana. God will remember Tzor, and she will return to Esnana. That is Yeshaya having fun again. What is an Etnan?
Etan is strength.
Good. That's the pun. Etan means strength, your stronghold. That's the pun. But an etnan in the Torah, like lo tavi etnan zona beit Hashem mecherkela beit Hashem alokecha, is the gift that one gives to a zona as payment.
Oh.
She is going to return le'etana, le'etnana. Exactly. This is a really important section in terms of understanding what's really going on in this whole thing. But that's the pun. Vizansa es kol mamlachos haaretz al pnei ha'adama, and she is going to go back again to being a zona across the land. Vaya sachara ve'es nana kodesh lashem, and then you get this really funny line. Her sahar, her merchandise, her sahara, her merchandise. Sahar is also used to go around something in Aramaic, but it's from that same idea. And her etnan will be kodesh lashem, dedicated to God, not kadesha, but kodesh. Lo yeyatzer v'lo yechasein, it will not be stored up somewhere. Kila yoshevim lifnei Hashem yesachara, her merchandise will be for those who dwell or sit before God. Le'chol lisov'a v'limachase atik, they will use it for their food, they will use it for their beautiful clothing. How do you like that ending?
Shocker.
What, you didn't see that coming. What in the world are we doing here? So, 70 years they will be out of the picture. Depending on who is destroying them, that will determine when this happens. Right? If it's Assyria that's destroying them, the way that Abarbanel believes, that means they're going to come back before the first temple is destroyed, before the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. You have more than 70 years until the Babylonians come along. However, if you take this as being the way most commentators do, the Babylonians are going to destroy us, then it's 70 years until we come back. And what it's saying is, when the Persians defeat the Babylonians and send us home, they're also going to send Tyre back home.
Is there any significance to the number 70?
Sorry? Any significance to the number 70? Well, according to this, it's parallel to our experience. The question really is, what is this statement of Kimei Melech Echad, like one king? The 70, I would have said, I think it's odd within a Abarbanel, it's just a random number. But if it's ours, parallel to our exile, we have 70 years, they have 70 years, then I understand it very well. But what is this like one king thing? So there are three different views I want to show you. Two main ones, and then one just because you have to know it. The first view is Radak's view, his first view anyway, which is that it is rebuke. Who was the king who lived for 70 years? David, right? David HaMelech lives for 70 years. It's in Shmuel, we're not going to look it up, it's in Shmuel Bet Perek Hey. It tells us that he's 30 years old when he takes the throne and he reigns for 40 years. So David is the one who reigns for 70 years. So you mention it here to say you betrayed the descendants of David with whom you had a covenant. You will be exiled for 70 years like the life of a king, David HaMelech. However, most say it's not that, but rather it's part of the prophecy of what is going to happen to them. In the interest of time and in the interest of clarity, I am not going to read with you what I brought you did I even bring it? I brought you one line in the, no, you know what? I skipped it on here, so you're good. Never mind. Ibn Ezra says the 70 years is indeed our Babylonian exile. The life of a king, it's Nebuchadnezzar, his son, and his grandson, rolled into one. And Malbim has that view as well, and that's what I brought you in number 11, that in the days of Cyrus, Tyre raised their head, was a merchant among the nations, when we came back to Israel. Radak says it's that their great empire will halt for the period of a king's lifespan. That's just a king. And then you have this other view. The Gemara in Sanhedrin in number 12 says, Melech Echad can't mean one king. It means the special king. And the special king is Mashiach. And what it's trying to tell me is that Mashiach will reign for 70 years.
That's all then.
That's no promise.
And then what, we die again?
Tchiyas HaMeisim and Mashiach are not necessarily the same thing. But he says, Mashiach will reign for 70 years. I brought it for you in number 12. That's the Gemara in Sanhedrin. My big problem with this Gemara is, why would you bury important information like that in some little prophecy about Sor? Like, this should be, you know, somewhere big. But that's the Gemara statement, Melech Echad. So, I'm going to come back to the idea that their product is Kodesh Lashem. We have to come back to that. But that's the end of the chapter. Is, yes, Tyre is going to fall. If someone could just hit the door, please, because they, the noise from outside. Thank you. Yes, Tyre is going to fall. However, they're going to come back. They'll be out of the picture for 70 years, either after the Assyrian invasion or after the destruction of the brought by the Babylonians, and then they will come back when we come back. A couple of notes on language in this chapter. Susan, you were going to say? No? Okay. Okay, well, if you're confused, then let's pause. Hang on.
I'm just trying to just get...
Yes.
Mashiach thing, I guess, is sort of like, it seems like...
out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yes. Agreed.
Like, no,
that's what Medrash does. You have to remember what Medrash's job is, right? The job of Medrash is to explain language, not to explain story, logic, law of the greater picture. It's an entirely different way to analyze a text.
I thought Medrash sort of was to give reasons of, like, our story backgrounds and why moral...
Right, and the answer is, generally speaking, not. Drash, by definition, is there in order to explain language. Often that will require expanding and explaining a story in order to understand what happened and why these words were used and why this way and not that way. It may end up involving a story, but the goal of Pshat is to explain a story. The goal of Drash is to explain language. And what this Medrash is concerned with here is, what's this Melech Echad? And so it says, because it means not echad meaning one, but echad meaning special.
So the pshat, which I always thought was just the simple, like the straightforward explanation,
yeah,
is to explain.
Pshat is concerned with an overall read. The pshat is superficial. It's, how does this story, how do I explain this? Just reading it straight. Like you're suggesting.
Because Rashi always says, "Avoid the pshat," but he always
gives drash. Because drash is often necessary to explain pshat.
Okay.
That's the problem. The two are entangled with each other. Gita.
Yes. In 17.
Yeah.
The pronoun, and she shall return to her hire. That is, she is Tzor.
Yes.
Not the Zonah.
But Tzor is the Zonah.
So what makes her turn around?
That's when she is restored. When, I mean, God is manipulating everything. This is God manipulating her return.
There's no change in her.
Not that we can
okay,
identify. Then again, we haven't identified an Avera either.
Well, I think I thought it was understood.
You mean that the Zanut is...
Yeah.
So that's where I'm going, but I'm not there yet. That's what I want to talk about in the overall theme, is this whole theme of commerce that runs through the entire chapter. Yeah.
Is this not also innkeeper.
Right. So the word zun, right, can read feed, right, and can read stray, and there are those who indeed will lump them together and say that it's both, because historically they often had two jobs, so to speak. There's a discussion in the commentators about Rachav as the classic example. Right, the Rachav was a Zonah. What does Zonah there mean? Also, in a few other places, with Shimshon, with the mother of Yiftach, like we have those those cases where the commentators say that it could be both.
And that's not a bad thing.
Well, I'm still pretty sure we consider it a bad thing.
Okay.
We're not fans now. Okay. No, it's not really what we're into. So yes, there's no tshuva here. Joyce points out, Gita pointed out, there's no tshuva. But then again, we haven't clearly identified an avera either. Language. Just a couple of points worth noting. First of all, back in sentence 4, he said Amar Yam. The sea says, "I have not produced children yet." So Rashi says it means Tzor says that. Tzor is on the sea. But the Midrashim have the sea actually speaking, which is fascinating. Second, I said I was going to come back to this. In sentence 8, this is important for elsewhere in Chumash and in Tanakh. the end of sentence 8, we said, her socharim, her merchants, are sarim, are nobles. Kin aneha, are nichbadei aretz. Kin aneha is a funny word. Kin aneha means merchants here. What we're doing, though, is this is one of the verses that the Gemara uses to demonstrate that the word Kena'ani does not necessarily mean Kena'anite, but rather means merchant. Merchant. Take a look, please, at source number 13. The Gemara in Psachim. Yehuda marries the daughter of an Ish Kena'ani. And that should cause our eyebrows to go up. As the Gemara says, Avram says, right, I don't want my son Yitzchak marrying a Kenani. Rivka says to Yitzchak, Yaakov shouldn't marry a Kenani, and Yaakov says, yes, dear, and he tells, Yitzchak says, yes, dear, and he tells Yaakov, don't marry a Kenani. So was Yehuda going to go marry one? Right, that whole medrash about how the Shvatim had twins and they married the different twin sisters is in order to solve this problem. They can't possibly have married Kenani. So how is it Yehuda's marrying Bas Ish Kenani? So the Gemara says, Reish Lakish says, it means the daughter of a merchant. What's my basis? He quotes you a pasuk in Hosea, Asher the Kenan biado moznei mirma. Kenan has in his hands scales of deception. Right? It's a merchant. And he also quotes our verse, Kin aneha nichbade aretz. Kin aneha is clearly parallel to Sochareha. So Kenani is actually a merchant. We find it in Zechariah as well. Right? Lo yet Kenani owed Beveis Hashem. Right? No longer will there be a Kenani in the house of Hashem Tzavakot. No Kenanim in the house of God. What do you mean? We say that everybody's able to come to the house of God. It doesn't mean no Kenani. It means no merchants. It's no merchants there in the house of God. And Professor Amos Chacham, hang on, I did... If you take a look at source number 14, he gives you a good etymology to explain it. Look at my translation there. He says, logically, at the start, Kena'ani referred to Tzidonim, meaning its original use in Hebrew. It meant Tzidonim, because as I noted in the beginning of the chapter, Kenan has a son named Noah has a son named Cham. Cham has a son named Kenan, and Kenan's firstborn is Tzidon. So Kenani meant Sidoni, and because the Kenanim were merchants, that's the way it came to mean merchant. I thought that was a very interesting explanation, and the only one I've ever seen to try to explain that. There are a couple of other language notes, but that was a key one I wanted to make sure to know. Yes. Eretz Kenan is still the land of the Kenanite tribes.
The tribes.
Yeah, the tribes that come from, yeah. Because Kenan also has the Chiti among his descendants. It's Sidon B'choro V'et Chet, and also the Yevusi are from Kenan. V'et HaKini, V'achar Nefotsu Mishpachot HaKenani. So they had more than just him. It's in Perek Yud. Okay. So, I'm not going to try to do the overall theme, because that's pushing it, I think. It's too bad. We'll just have to come back to it. But what I do want to note for you, because we started 2 minutes late, that's why this isn't right. So at least take a look at the questions for review at the bottom, because we now have enough information to be able to answer the first, the second, the third, and the fourth out of the 5 questions. So you can go home and do them for homework. You can email them, please, to somebody other than me. I am not grading them. If you really want to send it to me and to say, did I get it? I will be glad to look it over and just tell you got it. But I'm not giving number grades. That's how I draw the line. Thank you very much.